The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Riley, Judge Flory, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Good, we have our clock up there. Our first case this morning I'll call is A19-1681, Village Homes of Grandview Square 2 Association versus Fox Valley Contractors. Council, each of you has 15 minutes for your argument, and Council for Appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Do we have, let me just make sure we have both Council on. Who is Council? Please, could you tell me your name for the appellant?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is George Hottinger on behalf of the appellant, Fox Valley.
Great.
H-O-T-T-I-N-G-E-R.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good. Okay. And counsel for the respondent?
Good morning, Your Honor. John Steckler, S-T-E-C-K-L-E-R.
Great. Can everything okay from your end, too?
I'm hearing you okay. I'm having a little bit of difficulty hearing Mr. Hottinger, but...
Yeah, I agree, Mr. Hottinger, if you have like a, maybe be closer to the microphone or something. I don't know if you have a headset
okay.
or not.
Very good. Is this a little better?
A little bit. Do you have a headset or no? If you don't,
I do not, Your Honor.
Okay, just try and be close.
What I'll try to do is, maybe what I can do is move something. Does this help at all?
It does. It does.
I think so.
Okay, very good.
Great. Okay, and my colleagues, you all set to go? Okay. We're going to go, and I ask everyone when you're not speaking, if you could go on to mute. That makes the sound better for everybody, so everyone knows how to do that.
I better make sure I know how to do that, Your Honor.
Okay. There's like a, if you move your cursor around, there should be some buttons down at the bottom that show up, and there's a, if you see a microphone that has a line through it.
I'm just going to push it and see if that.
Yep, that does the trick. Okay.
Okay. Very good.
So I will start us off. You can see the clock there. And then, again, when we're not talking, we'll try and all go on mute. Otherwise, we have paper noises. And this is being recorded, of course, for the record. Counsel for Appellant, when you are ready, if you could please state the name and the party you represent for the record, and we'll go.
Your Honor, the appellant is ready to proceed. This is George Hottinger on behalf of Fox Valley. Your Honor, at this time, we're asking that the court vacate any judgments entered against Fox Valley, that the court set aside the verdict, and we're requesting this on a number of grounds. First, I want to begin with the statute of limitations. The claims accrued, Village Homes claims accrued, no later than September 26th of 2016. This court, in its May 7, 2018 opinion, determined that Fox Valley, as of August 31 of 2017, waived its service of process defense. The court also stated, though, that the issue of in personam jurisdiction did not relate to the statute of repose, an issue that was interlocutory and had not been developed at the trial court level. Fox Valley then at the trial court level sought a dismissal of any and all claims against it on the basis of the 2-year statute of limitations, which is within the statute of repose, MnStat 541.051, subdivision 2. So since any claims against Fox Valley did not attach until August 31 of 2017, those claims had expired. Now the trial court determined and reasoned that under the relation back doctrine, those claims commenced prior to September 26th of 2016. But in doing so, the trial court made an improper use of Rule 15.03. In effect,
before counsel, before we get to the relation back, I think there was an initial question, though, a finding by the district court, or as you call it, a conclusion that in fact service was effective on June 10th. And so you don't even need to get to the relation back. Can you address that, what's wrong in your view with that?
Yes, Your Honor. That first, the June 10, 2016 date corresponds to the third party complaint. June 10 is the date on which Mr. Greena, on behalf of REC signed an affidavit attesting that he delivered the third party summons and complaint to Linda Snyder. In this court's May 7, 2018 opinion, it refers to her as LS. She is a paralegal. Under the record before the trial court, the only person authorized to accept service on behalf of Fox Valley was the registered agent, Gregory McDonald. So that service was not effected as a matter of law. Even if it had, the third party complaint, which is cannot be used as the vehicle under which a cause of action is commenced for an entirely different party. The trial court relied upon 15.03 to say that the amended complaint, which was never served on Fox Valley, related back to the third party complaint. No case has ever been before this court in which this court or the Supreme Court has held that a third party complaint, even if lawfully commenced, serves to commence an action on behalf of a different party, here Village Homes. So the third party complaint, even if lawfully served, which we maintained it was not, only operated to commence a claim on behalf of REC. Your Honor, if I may address how the relation back doctrine is typically and customarily applied. It's applied to existing parties. So let's say that Village Homes, in bringing its complaint against REC, improperly named them as simply Ron Clark. Well, they would have lawfully served the agent for REC, but they improperly identified them as Ron Clark. Under those circumstances where you have existing parties, Rule 1503 allows that technical deficiency to be cured by way of relation back. Or if there was perhaps a derivative claim, the Grothy claim that we've cited, where the minor who commenced the claim for personal injury, the father was added as a derivative party. Again, the existing defendant had already been served. In those instances, that technical deficiency can be ameliorated with Rule 1503. 15.03, though, cannot be used to commence an action against an entirely different party. If this court were to affirm, it would be authorized in Rule 1503 as an independent basis for service of process when the party against whom process is being affected had no notice of the claims. Here are the third, assuming for argument.
What if they did have notice of the claim? Well, what do you mean by notice of what yes. claims? I guess, and do you read the relation back when a plaintiff is attempting to add a party and then argue relation back, add a defendant. Do you read that rule as only sort of permitting the swapping of a defendant to get the correct party, or can they add a defendant to get new claims against that defendant, or similar first, claims even?
But. Right. So to your first question, Judge, if the plaintiff did serve the party that they're seeking to add with process, so if the plaintiff affected service but misnamed that defendant, they can have that defendant's name corrected and then the complaint, amended complaint, can relate back. But you have to have service of process. Notice is service. The Tullis case, the Nelson case, all cases state that notice is the service of process. So here, there's no finding that the complaint or the amended complaint were ever served upon Fox Valley, so there was no notice. The third party complaint doesn't act as notice of a complaint or an action by a different party. Notice has always been read as the delivery of the summons identifying the party against whom relief is being sought. I see that the clock is ticking, Judge. I hope that answered your question.
Excuse me, keep going. Yes.
Okay. We're also asking that, so in all these instances, there was never any service of process over Fox Valley by Village Homes, then the statute of limitations expired as of September 26, 2016. Your Honor, we're also seeking a dismissal of the negligence claim on the basis that Fox Valley owed Village Homes no duty of care. This court, the Supreme Court, has always held that the duty to construct in a good and workmanlike manner only runs to or is owed to the contractee. Here, Fox Valley had no contract with Village Homes. The Pempton case that this court relied upon, holds specifically that that duty, which is implied into the contract between the property owner seeking relief from the party against whom the claim is being asserted, they have a contractual relationship. So this court decided that in the second chance case where a developer was being sued for defective construction by the property owner, those claims couldn't be maintained because the developer had no contract with the plaintiff. That's the situation we have here. Fox Valley had no contract with Village Homes. Village Homes' contract was with, of course, REC. REC owed that duty, and REC's duties were statutorily imposed by way of warranty. So the negligence claim should never have been asserted or allowed because there was no duty owed by Fox Valley to the non-contractee, Village Homes. Also, Your Honor, if I can, this kind of segues into the third-party beneficiary claim. The trial court over Fox Valley's objection submitted also a third-party beneficiary claim. The third-party beneficiary claim, this court, the Supreme Court, has never held that a third-party beneficiary claim can be asserted in the absence of a written contract. There was no written contract. That in and of itself was fatal to the position of Village Homes. But the trial court imposed against Fox Valley the duty owed prong of the test, and held that under the duty owed test, Fox Valley owed a contractual duty on a third-party beneficiary basis to Village Homes. But the duty that we had no written contract entered into evidence between Fox Valley and REC, but the duty that was owed by REC to Village Homes was the statutory duty, 515B4-113, those were the statutory duties, warranty duties that were imposed in the contract between REC and Village Homes. Fox Valley did not have those duties. So the duties have to be one and the same. So the duty owed test failed. But then finally, and perhaps most importantly, Village Homes can only assert a third-party beneficiary claim if it does not have the right to otherwise enforce that claim. Village Homes enforced against REC a contractual claim, a negligence claim, a breach of warranty claim, and settled those claims and admitted that it had the opportunity and the right to proceed against REC. That also defeats the third-party beneficiary claim. Now, Your Honor, the manner in which
Counsel, on that latter point, I see the language that you cite from cases relative to the ability to enforce. Is there any case in which that, like these facts, where a subcontractor, where there is not an intended beneficiary because a general can be sued too? Is there any case like these facts that you know?
I'm not aware of any case like that, Your Honor. There's no case in which Village Homes has cited to this court in which that type of claim has been asserted when the property owner can bring the claim against the party with whom it has the contract. Nor is there any case cited to this court in which, without a written contract, the claim can be asserted. Then, Your Honor, I hope that answered your question. Moving on, the manner in which these claims were prosecuted against Fox Valley is also prohibited by law. And here what I have in mind would be the case law that has always stated that here Fox Valley relied upon plans and specifications that were furnished to it by REC. The genesis, or basically the gravamen of the theory of recovery that Village Homes is asserting, is that Fox Valley should not have followed those plans and specifications. The expert for Village Homes expressly admitted that Fox Valley followed the plans and specifications when it installed the accent bands. Fox Valley followed the plans and specifications when they installed the Weep Screen. The plaintiff, Village Homes, is seeking a recovery on the basis that Fox Valley should have done something differently. But the case law has always held that a contractor, Fox Valley, can rely upon the plans and specifications furnished to it. Otherwise, it's put in the untenable position of, on the one hand, exposing itself to a claim from the party that is expecting it to follow the plans and specifications, yet on the other hand, being exposed to a claim by a party who said it shouldn't be following those plans and specifications. Here, Village Homes, though, was able to recover against REC on the basis that they were providing defective plans through the architect they retained. But Fox Valley, in following those plans and specifications, is not liable for the consequences of any defects in those plans and specifications. Also, the claim for which Village Homes, Your Honor.
Council, I'm sorry. Can I ask you, before we run out of time, you may have some more to get to, but I just want to circle back to the first issue for a moment on the statute of limitations. What, because there was waiver of the defense of insufficient process, and that we've already decided that defense was waived, does that also waive a challenge to the district court's determination that process was in fact effective on June 10th? Why doesn't it waive that? Why wouldn't we just have to accept that June 10th date?
The court, in its opinion, the May 7, 2018 opinion, said that the waiver itself does go to in personam jurisdiction, but it does not waive or bear upon the statute of limitations defense.
Right. I'm not saying that we previously decided it, but I'm saying now, in looking at the effective date of service, which is for purposes of the statute of limitations argument, the issue now, considering that Fox Valley waived a challenge to effective service, does that waiver also include the inability to challenge the June 10th, 2016 determination by the district court that service was effective on that date? And if not,
no, Your Honor, the effect of the waiver is that the jurisdiction attaches effective on the date of the waiver, which was August 31 of 2017. So that is the date on which the waiver was effected. That's when it filed its summary judgment motion. So for purposes of the statute of limitations and whether service itself was effective, that goes to the statute of limitations, an independent issue. That waiver does not go back. And that's pursuant to the case, the Patterson Wu case, the MG Ag case. The trial court here, in denying the statute of limitations defense, did not do so on that basis, Judge. It applied the waiver back, the relation back doctrine, to that date.
Okay. Thank you, Counsel.
Well, I'll get back to it in my rebuttal,
yep,
Judge.
You'll have time for a rebuttal. So if you could maybe just hit your mute button, which you found before. And then, Mr. Steckler, I don't think you were muted during that argument, so you, I think, are ready to go now. So if you could just state your name and party you represent, please.
John Steckler, appearing on behalf of the respondent, Village Homes of Grandview Square 2. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. If the panel has any questions for me before I begin, I'd be happy to address them right now. If not,
let's focus then on the statute of limitations issue. Let's leave aside the relation back question. Why can't the June 10th effective date of service for statute? Well, let me put it this way. To determine the statute of limitations defense, if a district court has two defenses that are presented to it, ineffective service of process and statute of limitations, district court decides, yep, process was ineffective, turns then to the statute of limitations question. What is a district court looking at? What should a district court look at to determine when the action was commenced for statute of limitations purposes? What is the rule that a district court should follow?
Generally, Your Honor, the statute of limitations would begin to run, or the outside date is commencement of the action. and generally commencement of the action is indeed service. However, in this case, it's unique because we have a couple of different circumstances in which the action was commenced. And one is obviously waiver, and as this court found, waiver is waiver. Mr. Hottinger goes a bit far when he says that this court found that the waiver or that commencement or the waiver is effective on the date that an action that it filed its summary judgment motion constituted the waiver. The court didn't say that. The court said by that date, by that time, they had waived, okay? And the timing of it is irrelevant. Waiver is waiver. Once it's waived, it's waived. It cannot control.
Counsel, the timing is, the district court needs to find a commencement date in order to measure the statute of limitations, right? So, for example, if there was ineffective waiver, service that's waived prior, I mean, at the time that a statute of limitations had already run, let's say that all of the attempted ineffective service was all late, you know, the defendant's going to still win on a statute of limitations argument. So you have to, the district court has to peg its statute of limitations analysis to some date, does it not?
No, it doesn't. Once the defense is waived, it's waived. It can't be raised. So it doesn't matter.
So what if the statute of limitations
argument goes away?
So even if, under that theory, even if service was never, let's say there was ineffective service after the statute of limitations has run. Okay?
Okay.
So the statute of limitations has run and there's ineffective service. A defendant waives the ineffective service argument by not bringing it in a similar way. Have they also lost their statute of limitations claim?
If they've waived it by some other action?
If all of the attempted service was too late. But, so I'm just trying to imagine service that's ineffective that also violates the statute of limitations.
I'm not following your question, Your Honor, but it's a scenario that we're not dealing with here, respectfully.
I know that, but I'm trying to think of a rule, because the rule in MW in the Eighth Circuit case is, okay, if you have no effective service, for whatever reason, because the process server kept it in their drawer, because they mailed it to the wrong place, they never served the defendant. How does a district court determine whether there was a timely action brought for statute of limitations purposes? And to me, you seem to be saying, there's no determination anymore. You cannot win on a statute of limitations argument. And that is both contrary to the Eighth Circuit case, and I want to know what's wrong with that rule, but also seems a little weird to me because maybe a case is late.
Yeah, the Eighth Circuit case, Your Honor, I would note is, I would say it's aberrant. It seems to be reliant upon particular facts, but also it's not precedential in Minnesota, and no Minnesota case has ever cited it for that proposition. I think that, frankly, the if you want to call it a rule from that case, is simply wrong, and it's not applicable in Minnesota. But going back to what Your Honor was saying, I guess, in our scenario here, we did have service. There was service of process. The third-party summons and complaint was served personally. It was served at the registered agent's office on a person, the paralegal for the attorney who was identified as the registered agent. And again, this is a law firm. This isn't, you know, a bake shop. This is a law firm that performs agent of process services, like, you know, CT Corp or whoever that might be. So again, the document wasn't just dropped off, you know, on someone's doorstep. It was left at the registered agent's office by someone who said they were authorized to accept service. Based on that, the amended complaint was served by mail under Rule 5.02. Then, Your Honor, we have relation back.
Okay, the before we get to relation back, can I ask you about the service? So if they go to a law firm, that's the agent. They don't serve the actual identified lawyer who's the agent. Can they serve, is it proper service under what rule and what authority is there that it's proper service to leave it with some other person at the law firm, not the corporation, but some other purpose at the person at the law firm that's the agent, to leave it with other than that agent? What does that satisfy in terms of service?
I think it's the apparent authority, Your Honor, under the rule.
Implied
authority. Again, based on the circumstances and the facts presented to the district court. Again, the facts that the court found and upon which it made these legal conclusions have to be reviewed for clear error. The fact was A professional process server took that document to the law firm that provides agent of process services. Somebody had to be identified as the agent for process, okay? Yes, it was Mr. McDonald. Mr. Greena asked for Mr. McDonald. His paralegal said, came out and said, yep, I'll take it. I talked with the attorney in charge of this department, and he said, yeah, we don't just take things and throw them away. We take them and we forward them on to the client. These are the facts before the court.
I don't see any facts by the district court, factual findings relative to whether there was implied authority. I see a fact. I see what's called a factual finding that it was effective. But what's the implied authority? Can you explain how? What's required of implied authority? Does it have to be implied by the defendant? And if so, what's the implied authority here? It's different from.
It's implied. It's implied by the circumstances. Again, that they put this, they put the burden or the onus on a company that accepts process as part of its business, and that's where process was served. So I would say that, that under the circumstances of it, it's not getting it into the hands of any one particular person. It's getting it to that company that provides those services.
And do you have any case authority for that when there's a named individual as an agent that anyone at that individual's place of employment can be a has implied authority to accept it?
Offhand, Your Honor, I don't know. I don't know if we've referenced it in our I know we addressed this issue in our pleadings. I don't know if we cited anything specifically on that issue.
Yeah, I don't see anything really in your brief on appeal that defends the service itself, except to say that it's a clearly erroneous standard of review. And I, that's what I'm trying to apply here. Is there a what are the factual findings and what's clear error? But go ahead. So then you can continue your argument. Then you argue then that the you never made an argument. I don't think that the the service by mail was the effective date. It was always the June 10th REC third party complaint that's the effective date.
No, that was effective. And then based on that, the service by mail was also effective because once a party's been served at an address, you can serve another party can serve them in that in that action by mail. Which is what we did then with the third party, or I'm sorry, the amended complaint. So that's the genesis of that argument.
Okay, but the effective date of commencing the action, you rely on the June 10th REC third party complaint. Is that right or not?
Well, it depends on whether we're talking about the relation back doctrine or whether we're talking about the actual service.
Okay.
I mean, I would say that under relation back, yes, it can be as early as June 13 of 2016 when Fox Valley's president accepted a letter which included the amended complaint and a copy of the plaintiff's original complaint. If we're talking about actual service, then it was June 30th piggybacking on the June 10th service. Either way, it's irrelevant because under either circumstance, it's going to be timely. I'm sorry, it doesn't matter which, because either way, it's under either timeline, it's timely.
Okay, if we were to decide that the service on the third-party complaint service by REC on Fox Valley did not satisfy the rules of service, that was not effective service to leave it with a paralegal,
yep.
What happens to your relation back argument?
Relation back doesn't require actual service. The analysis, and again, this is where Fox Valley is a bit misleading in its pleadings. Under relation back, the analysis is not service. It's notice and prejudice. And Judge McGill went into great detail in this in his opinion or in his order. It's not service. It's notice and lack of prejudice. The rule is designed so that parties will get notice and that they'll have an opportunity to participate without being prejudiced. It is critical to remember here that Fox Valley never once argued, never once stated in any context that it did not get actual notice back in June of 2016. Also, Fox Valley never claimed or argued that it was prejudiced. As Judge McGill said, all it has ever relied on was alleged technical deficiencies. And that isn't the purpose of the service rules, again, Your Honor. The purpose of the service rules are to allow people notice.
Just a second. So if we have a case where a defendant is never effectively served, was not served at all, okay? Was not served effectively, and let's just assume that. And then a party brings an amended complaint, that they also don't effectively serve. It says that defendant knew about this lawsuit. Therefore, you must, under Rule 15, even though the statute of limitations has run, because the defendant knew about a lawsuit, even though they've never been effectively served, Rule 15, you're saying defeats the statute of limitations defense. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any case for that where there's never been an effective service of a pleading on a defendant?
I don't know. I didn't look specifically for that, Your Honor. I can tell you, though, that the rule and the case law is that, and again, contrary to what Mr. Hottinger represents, Rule 15 does specifically contemplate bringing in a new party because it references bringing in a new party, all right? And again, it's not like a situation where a party brings a like my client brought an action against REC and other parties for defective construction, okay? It's not like we are then bringing in Fox Valley alleging medical malpractice. In the complaint, the complaint never, ever included a warranty claim. Again, Mr. Hottinger repeatedly states that it didn't, that we brought warranty claims. We never brought a warranty claim against anybody, nor a product defect claim. But anyway, our complaint, the original complaint and the amended complaint are identical. They're identical, except in the amended complaint, we identify third parties that we didn't know the identity of before. And in the original complaint, they're identified. It's unidentified subcontractors, including the stucco contractor. So when Fox Valley got that document in its hands on June 13, it knew that this action had been commenced, and it knew that the action would have been commenced against it had my client, had we known the identity of Fox Valley. And that's the test under Rule 15.02. Does that help address the question?
Does your complaint bring an act, does it use that language about unidentified subcontractors?
It does. It does.
And yes. Asserts direct claims against unidentified contractors in the original complaint?
It alleges the same transaction and occurrences against REC and unidentified subcontractors. We don't have, there's two causes of action, okay? One for breach of contract.
This is Judge Riley, excuse me. I have a question though, because we have cases like the Turret case that say whether a plaintiff substantially complied with service of process or a defendant had actual notice of the lawsuit is irrelevant. That may be true later on, but that with regard to the service of process to commence a lawsuit, the technicalities do matter.
Which case, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
There's Turek, there's a whole line of cases about that.
In the context of relation back, Your Honor?
No, this is getting back to before we got to relation back. You were saying that as long as Fox Valley had notice, as I'm understanding your argument, had notice of the lawsuit, that was enough and we shouldn't get hung up on technicalities.
Nope. Two different arguments, Your Honor, and I'll agree with you. When we're talking about actual service, then the courts have said, yes, technicalities do matter. But I would argue that we have actually observed all necessary technicalities in accomplishing actual service. It is under the relation back doctrine where the court has said, okay, it's not actual service that we look at, it's notice, opportunity, and lack of prejudice. And I can see that my time has expired here.
My colleagues, do you have other questions or this time? Okay. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes rebuttal.
Okay. Is my mute button? I better get that, Judge.
You're good to go. I can hear you. Oops. Now take it back. There you
sorry.
Go. You're
okay.
Good.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honor, I want to pick up with Justice Riley's question about notice. And the line of cases that Justice Riley cites, that's in line with the Tullis decision, the Nelson versus Glenwood Hills decision, all those decisions state that notice is the delivery of the summons and complaint. Here we have no service of either the complaint or the amended complaint upon Fox Valley. There is no notice.
But what about the argument, counsel? The argument, though, I think is Rule 15 doesn't talk about service. It talks about notice. And if your client actually had notice because they were already brought in as a third-party defendant or what have you, they knew it from their, you know, the tender offer whatever, or letter or whatever, you know, I don't think that's what Rule 15 talks about. And I don't think they talk about effective service. They talk about adding someone and relating it back.
Yes, in all the decisions in which a party is added, the party that's, it's not an entirely new party. It's the same party that was previously served but was misidentified. None of those cases involve a new party, Judge. So whether it's the Nelson case, whether it's any of the cases that have been cited, whether it's the Grothy case, all of those defendants had previously been served. They were not new parties. They were misidentified. Rule 1503 refers to a party that's not properly identified, or there's some technical deficiency in the pleadings between the existing parties. It does not authorize the addition of a new party that was not served, and notice remains the delivery of the summons and complaint. So that's all those cases state, Your Honor, and I just urge the court to look at those cases. All of them involve a defendant who was previously served but not properly identified, or there's some technical defect in the pleadings. As to just completing my thoughts where I was running out of time on the June 10 date, that third-party complaint has to be independently evaluated for purposes of service under the statute of limitations. When does the claim begin for purposes of the statute of limitations? The trial court just relied upon its declaration that the service on Linda Snyder, the service that there was service on June 10 without any underlying evidence that the registered agent was served. But even if we overlook that fundamental deficiency that there was no service, the amended complaint.
Before you go there though, counsel, why isn't there implied authority when the paralegal at the firm that's, you know, the law firm that's does this for business, the paralegal's authority saying, I have the authority to accept this. Why doesn't that satisfy the implied authority for service under the rule?
There are no findings on that, Judge.
Well, whether there are findings or not, there's undisputed evidence, I think, of what happened at service. So let's just assume
we have the affidavit of Mr. Greena in which he said he delivered the papers to Ms. Snyder, a paralegal. We also have the unequivocal and unrefuted the Secretary of State pleading in which the only registered agent was Mr. McDonald. Linda Snyder, there's no history that Linda Snyder ever had any authority to sign or accept delivery of process.
But why isn't it implied authority under 4.03 sub C or whatever that is, where it's if you serve an agent or someone who has implied authority?
She has to have agent to accept on behalf of the corporation. She's not an officer. She's not an agent. She's not an employee of Fox Valley. Only the registered agent can serve. There's no evidence that she had any implied authority. Your Honor, I'm just going to complete with the claims that were asserted and were proven at trial were for replacement stucco, not damage. The claims that were asserted at trial were all based on Fox Valley following plans and specifications. These claims were not properly prosecuted because there's no basis to prosecute those claims. The contractor's not liable for following plans and specifications in a negligence claim.
Let me stop you, Mr. Hotton, this is Judge Flory. I have a question. I understand your arguments. I've read the briefs. I've heard your arguments now. But I remain troubled by this concept that it's been found that you have waived challenge to the service jurisdictional defense, and presumably the facts that you might have been able to argue to support that claim, yet you can still argue those same facts now to support your statute of limitations argument. It just seems like bootstrapping. It just seems wrong to me, quite frankly, once you've waived that you can now argue those same facts that you've waived for a different purpose.
Well, Your Honor, I'm just relying on the statement of this court in the May 7, 2018 opinion, wherein the court stated that the consent to jurisdiction in personam jurisdiction of finding that jurisdiction itself has been waived does not bear upon the statute of limitations issue, which is independent of that. The statute of limitations, in evaluating that defense, you still have to have a starting point for the claim. And third-party complaint can't serve as a starting point. An amended complaint, a complaint, they can't relate back to that third-party complaint, even if it was validly served. This court can still independently review, for purposes of the statute of limitations, whether process was affected on June 10 of 2016, and even if it was, whether a complaint, an amended complaint that were never served, can relate back to that third-party complaint of a different party. Are there any other, I'm sorry, mute buttons are on.
You've answered my question, thank you.
Yep. Okay. And counsel, I think you're out of time. Do my colleagues, do you have any more questions?
None here.
Great, okay. Thank you both of you for your oral arguments today. It went smoothly from both of you. I hope it went okay for you. It was easy to pay attention to, and I know we're not in a courtroom, and that's too bad, but I really appreciate your arguments, and it was well-briefed and presented, and we'll get a decision out within the statutory time period.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I think you, counsel, then signs off, and I think we belong here while we go into a waiting room then.
All right, I'm out of here.
Thank you.